Joining us this afternoon, we have Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins. And with that, good afternoon, gentlemen. Thanks for joining us.
Afternoon, Lockwood.
Good afternoon, Lockwood.
All right.
Lockwood, today, let's discuss this infamous hat that some people wear called being an executor.
Uh-huh.
And an executor is a fiduciary, meaning they work on behalf of another. They are handling the affairs or the assets of another, not necessarily their own assets. That is really kind of a fundamental explanation of a fiduciary, one that holds money and handles money, and or not just money, but any asset, land, stocks, bonds, boats, cars, property that they do not necessarily personally own, but they are handling it on behalf of another.
Mm-hmm.
That, of course, is kind of fundamental fiduciary law. Now, some more terminology, Lockwood, that's just kind of interesting for our listeners. Sometimes these are kind of old-fashioned words, but sometimes we refer to the executor as the executor, and then the feminine version of that is the executrix.
Mm-hmm.
You might hear that every now and then. Sometimes you hear the word administrator and administratrix, which basically is, again, the duties are the same as the executor, but it means that there was not necessarily an appointment under a last will and testament, but rather due to the North Carolina statute, this person is serving as the administrator of the estate,
mm-hmm.
or the female version being administratrix. Now, we don't really use those terms much anymore. We just throw everything into one category called the executor.
Mm-hmm.
But Lockwood, the executor begins with the duties of marshaling together all of the assets, getting a handle on what is in the estate of the decedent. And at our first appointments at our office that Wes and I handle, we really kind of ask those questions. Tell me about the land holdings. Tell me about the automobile holdings. Where did the decedent bank? Did the decedent have an investment firm that held certain stocks or bonds or other kinds of investments? Tell me about the life insurance. Tell me about the non-probate assets like a retirement account or an annuity. And the bottom line is that we begin by marshaling together, inventorying preliminarily, of course, initially, these assets. And then we review carefully the last will and testament and or the statutory disposition, if there is no will, and begin the discussion of how things might be divided. For instance, if mom and dad owned a particular piece of real estate, maybe the son or the daughter, as part of their inheritance, want to take over the home. Maybe they're already living in the home, or maybe it was always determined that they would take title to the home upon the death of their parent or grandparent. So we begin to kind of discuss the big picture of how and when the assets would get divided by the executor. Now, all of this sounds wonderful, but what happens, Lockwood, if this executor, this fiduciary, who is in fact held, that's why I started out the program by saying the fiduciary is responsible for the assets of another, not their personal assets, but the assets of their mom or dad or grandmother or whoever it happens to be. What begins to happen if they are not acting properly,
mm-hmm.
or they just aren't acting at all? I actually had a file very recently that is those facts, that the executor just simply isn't acting at all. And we are now 3 or 4 years post death. This person died in 2020, 2021, and we are still just holding on to property here and property there and renting a little something here and renting a little something over there. But there doesn't seem to be much movement forward. There doesn't seem to be a lot of organization in the way in which the executor in this particular file is handling the assets. And so Wes and I many times are confronted with the fact that the executor, the fiduciary, is not necessarily moving at the pace that we think is appropriate or reasonable, and that they are also taking actions that are self-dealing and or are just inappropriate under all of the circumstances of fiduciary law, where, after all, they are holding resources for the benefit of another. And I'm going to let Wes chime in here a minute, because in our office, when these situations come forward, they do kind of move many times out of my office, my staff, and move over to Wes's staff. We're all in one law firm, of course, and we all work together on everything. But Wes will chair up the litigation of these files, and his assistant lawyers, associate lawyers, and paralegals will take over the duties here. But one more thing I want to say is that Lockwood, and I know Wes would say this as well, but right at the very beginning, it's not easy to remove an executor. Ooh. It is not a casual event. And here comes why. The will, the last will and testament of the decedent, named this particular person. So our loved one, our person who is no longer living, chose this particular person in their written document, signed, notarized, and witnessed. And so the clerk of court, the courts in general, are not going to remove a named person in a document without very significant, strong, and overwhelming evidence. And relative to an estate where there is no will, the North Carolina statutes then dictate an order of appointment, being maybe it's the spouse, maybe it's the child, maybe it's the brother, the sister, whatever the order happens to be. But again, they are appointed because that's what the North Carolina statute dictates as to who is to be appointed. Mm-hmm. And so when Wes goes into these files, we come in, if you will, from the back end, because we are undoing the written document of the decedent, and or we are undoing, if you will, the North Carolina statute. And so it is not going to be something that is casually reviewed. It is going to have a real element of significance. In light of the fact that we are attempting to remove a fiduciary. And so with that, Wes, you take it from there.
Lockwood, you know, we're on both sides of these situations. And sometimes we're in a situation where we're what I call on the outside looking in. And what I'm referring to there is we don't represent the estate. We represent most likely a beneficiary of the estate, and we're concerned about the actions or inactions of the fiduciary, the executor of the estate. So that would be a situation where we would be filing a petition to revoke letters testamentary or letters administration before the clerk of court to have this person removed. Sometimes we're on the inside where we represent the estate, and there may be a petition to have the executor removed by someone else who has standing, like a beneficiary of the estate. Mm-hmm. Now, if we represent the estate, it's very, very rare that we have a situation where one of our executors is subject to a petition to revoke their letters, because we make it very clear that to them their responsibilities, and we hold their hand through their responsibilities to make sure they are not misstepping,
mm-hmm.
to make sure they are not breaching their fiduciary duty. Now, in some, the two circumstances that the clerk of court primarily looks at, because this is under the statute, under 28A, North Carolina General Statute 28A, in that section of law regarding estates, regarding the removal of an executor, is really two primary issues when you're talking about removal for cause. One issue would be they have a conflict of interest, which is, I would say, certainly more rare than the second. The second would be they have breached one of their duties. Okay, so a conflict of interest may be something like, let's say that the executor owns a piece of real estate and the decedent owned a portion of it as well. Let's mm-hmm. say they owned it together. And let's say there's something going on with the real estate. And let's say, for example, and this could even pour over into the second issue. Let's say the will requires that piece of real estate, you know, to be sold.
Right.
Okay, upon the death, it has to be sold within a year or something like that. Let's say that this executor, because of his or her own personal interest in that other, let's say, one half of the property, doesn't want to sell it.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they have a friend who's going to buy it, and they want to buy it in 2 years, but they can't buy it quite yet. Well, that strikes of your personal interest getting in the way of your
right.
job.
Right.
So that could be the type of situation where there would be a conflict. You see, that kind of pours over into the second category as well, because if the will requires the property to be sold, let's say, within a year, and you're not doing that, then you're breaching one of your duties as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, but those are the type of things that the court looks at. Normally, the court is not going to remove an executor for being late on a filing, for being late on a inventory, for maybe something being inaccurate on an inventory, as long as it's caught and corrected in a timely manner. But if you have repeated episodes of mistakes, or if you have just absolute dilatory tactics, and you have purposeful delay, or you have, let's say, an order of the court that requires some action by a particular time, and it may be because there's a hearing where there was a request for the executor to do something by a particular time, and that's not followed after an actual order is entered, then that could, those things seem kind of insignificant, but they can rise to the level of being a basis for an executor to be removed. So that's, and I'm going to come back to executors being removed and the petition and how that works from a boots on the ground process, and what the trial looks like and the appeal rights and those kind of things. But I also want to mention that that's not the limit of the remedy. In the event that you have an executor who is breaching their duty, then they're inviting potentially a lawsuit against them personally for breach of fiduciary duty. You know, let's say we had an executor who's entitled to 25% of this estate, and let's say that they have just grossly delayed and maybe even cause waste as a result of the delay.
Mm-hmm.
And let's say the beneficiaries get fed up with it. They hire a lawyer and they sue the fiduciary. Well, and then you know, the court comes back and finds that there was a breach of fiduciary duty, and that this is a jury matter if the, in the event the petitioner wants a jury. And let's say the jury determines that the damages were, you know, pick a number, $100,000. Well, it's a pretty easy, it's pretty easy to collect that $100,000 from that person's 25% inheritance.
Right.
So you almost have a built-in, not only, you know, the lawsuit situation, you have a built-in remedy within the estate for paying the judgment that the court imposes from the actual inheritance that you otherwise, as a beneficiary, would have received that 25%.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, we don't see that very often, but it's certainly the case. I just filed a lawsuit, just finished reviewing it yesterday, so it'll probably be filed today. This is not a local case. It's in a different county in North Carolina, different jurisdiction. But the situation was the administrator of the estate, who was the spouse who married the elderly gentleman very shortly before he died, she became the administrator because we didn't think, or nobody thought, and I wasn't involved at the time, thought that there was a will.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't find a will. So she was the administrator. Well, while she was the administrator for 6 months, give or take, she took assets and spent estate assets, spent them for her own benefit. She took no action with regard to some very questionable activity that took place before the decedent's death when he was not in a condition to make decisions for himself. He purportedly signed a deed to a $600,000-$700,000 piece of property, of course, over to her at a time when he was in terrible condition. So there was almost an inherent conflict right there. She had him sign three beneficiary designation, actually changing individual accounts to joint accounts.
Mm-hmm.
So she did a lot of things to help herself. And she also breached her duties through the administration of the estate. So time goes on, a matter of months, and the children, these are his natural children, because his wife of many, many years, probably 60 years, had passed away. And then this younger person who was the administrator who got him to sign these things kind of swung into action. Whew. And they got purportedly married right before he passed away. Well, they found a handwritten will in the house. So that will left everything to the children. Not to her, left her nothing. So that will was presented to the court in this other county with the appropriate affidavits. This was what we call a holographic will.
Mm-hmm.
It had all the markings of a holographic will. It was all in his handwriting. He was found with his important papers. It was the original. We had affidavits. It was signed by him, affidavits that it was
his signature,
his handwriting.
Right.
And so that was it. And his signature, it was submitted to probate in this other county and accepted. So as a result of that, she was removed. This administrator was removed as administrator. So that removal process, Lockwood, was as a result of another will mm-hmm. being found.
Right.
But now, where is she? Well, she'll be served with a lawsuit here in the next, you know, couple weeks.
Oh.
Because I prepared it,
and
we're filing it because she has to account for her actions of taking estate assets for her benefit. That's a breach of fiduciary duty during the administration. She's going to have to account for these documents that she had signed when the medical records and witnesses will indicate he was in no condition to do so. So she's got some
serious questions. Problems. Yeah,
she's got some questions to answer. So that is how sometimes some of these things look. It's not only the actions that she took prior to his death, but you know, kind of sticking with today's program, it's also a breach of fiduciary duty with regard to how she operated the estate. And basically what she did was she didn't have an attorney. She didn't have anyone giving her direction, but she acted as though everything was hers.
Right.
So she just used the state assets however she wanted to, as though there's no one else involved, ignored the rights of the children, because they had rights too as an intestate heirs. And now everything but for the items that she got changed right before, right before he passed away, goes to the children. And then there's an issue about whether she is going to file an elective share. Mm-hmm. So that's there's a lot of overlap of breach of fiduciary duty, spousal rights, intestate law, meaning when you file out a will, holographic wills, probate. There's a lot of that involved in that fact pattern I just gave you. It kind of sounds like a bar exam question,
right?
But it's real world. I mean, you don't act with impunity as a administrator. You have to do things properly, and we're able to see how you acted. And in the event that you breached your responsibilities, then you may be personally, liable for it.
Wes, real quick question, and of course we're talking with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins, and that was Wes Collins a few moments ago. We're going to continue on. We're talking about the issue of fiduciary responsibility as an executor or an administrator of an estate. A quick question on this in relationship, and if someone is named a fiduciary or an administrator, two questions. First, this sounds like it could be a time-consuming issue for that individual. Is there any compensation for that individual? And the second issue is, when does that responsibility come to an end, real quickly?
Responsibility comes to the end upon the estate being closed.
Okay.
And that's when the clerk of court approves all the accountings, the disbursements, all the actions, the attorney's fees, the commission, everything that's been done, signs off on the final accounting. The estate is closed. We're done.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Until then, you're a fiduciary.
Okay.
As it relates to, I'm glad you brought this up because I have another short story on this, but compensation. Yes, the executor has the right to up to 5%. This does not include real estate. It includes what we refer to as personal property in and out of the estate, in and out. But however, that would include in the event that we sold a piece of real estate and then that money came in and then it's dispersed out, that's 10% of that. So we had one particular case that was interesting, that the executor was seeking some $300,000 or $400,000 of commission. Now, this was a pretty large estate, but not enough to support commission of that much, $300,000 or $400,000.
Right.
And so we started looking very closely. We were on the outside looking in. We represented the beneficiaries.
Mm-hmm.
At the basis upon why they were seeking so much commission. And this was included in tens of thousands of pages of documents that were produced, a lot of which was just fluff.
Wow.
Almost to the point where it was, felt as though they were trying to just overload us with paperwork so that we couldn't see what they were doing. So what ended up happening is that there was a company that was owned by the decedent that was operating during the administration of this estate. Now, we had filed a petition to revoke letters because the administrator, the executor, had kept this estate open for 6 years and really had not provided us a good explanation as to why they'd done that. Now, they had an attorney, large law firm out of the Raleigh area that was supporting what they were doing. And I think, kind of supporting things that shouldn't have been done, but that the court ended up agreeing with us. But what we found was that is to support this commission, they were reporting deemed distributions of money that they said came into the estate, out of the estate, through the this business that was ongoing during the administration of the estate. And therefore, 5% in, 5% out.
Wow.
These $7 million, $8 million, $10 million that was coming in and out, that was the basis upon which they were seeking this high commission. Well, when we got down into the paperwork and got into the accountings, the ledgers, the bank records, we found that they reported that money coming into the estate and out, and that would technically support a large commission, but the money never went into the estate.
Oh.
It was reported as deemed. That was false. It just went out from the business to a trust, okay? And they argued that supported, you know, the commission.
Uh-huh.
So we were able to show, and we had a big argument before the clerk of court on this and before the Superior Court and went to the Court of Appeals. There's a case. This is kind of where the research, or, you know, doing your due diligence, doing your work, being prepared for hearings comes in. But there's a case in North Carolina that specifically dealt with a situation regarding when you're entitled to a commission, and it expressly stated you're only entitled to that commission based on personal property in and out, not reported in and out. So their reporting that money came in and out of this estate was not sufficient, no matter where it ended up, to support that large commission. So these co-executors, there was an accountant involved and an individual. They were both removed. They were not allowed their commission.
Wow.
And then they had a whole host of other issues that ended up happening as a result of them really just being greedy. That's pretty much what it came down to. But Ooh. It was a very sophisticated plan of greed that we had to peel back the layers of the onion to show what they were doing through the support of their CPA and lawyers. But wow. It was something that was not allowed, and the effect of it would have been that it would have taken hundreds of thousands of dollars out of our client's pocket and put it in their pocket in commission, but we did not allow that to happen.
You know, we're talking with Wes Collins. We're talking with Wes Collins and Cecil Harvell of Harvell and Collins about the issue of fiduciary responsibility, as well as the activities of as an executor or an administrator. Before we wrap it up with you, Wes and Cecil, the topic then goes to the issue of responsibility as an executor or an administrator. It strikes me that one of the things that coming from this conversation is, if you are selected as an administrator or an executor, you should look for professional assistance. You can't, as you said with this lady who's was the wife of the decedent, you should not assume that you can take these tasks on with impunity. That's the number one item I'm coming from our conversation, Wes.
Well, I would mention that briefly, and Cecil may have something to mention about it, but I've been an attorney for 25 years, and I would say during the first 10 years of my practice, I think that it was much more acceptable to handle the administration of a state without the assistance of a competent attorney. But in the last 15 years, I would say that for lots of factors, including what the court is requiring, the oversight by the administrative office of the courts as it relates to estate administration that then passes on to the clerk of court and their heightened requirements, the liability associated therewith, I can't really put my finger on or really identify any type of situation other than the absolute simplest of situations where I would recommend to handle the administration of an estate without a lawyer. It's just too complicated these days.
Cecil, any comment?
Yes. One of the things, though, that we're hearing from Wes's perspective, of course, in these different cases, Lockwood, is very clear and convincing evidence of mm-hmm. of the fact that there's been wrongdoing. And as I started out the program, Lockwood, that is generally what a fiduciary law litigation attorney is going to want to see in order to accept representation.
Right.
If it's just because the executor has been a little slow, hasn't necessarily made disbursements yet, seems to be kind of holding back for whatever reason, those are the kinds of things where, yes, there might be some letter writing back and forth. There might be some petition, but the clerk will at that point kind of encourage the existing executor to move the ball, not necessarily remove the executor, but put some orders and put some time frames into the settlement of the estate. In order to remove the executor, we go back to where we started at the very beginning, Lockwood. In order to actually have an order of removal, there would have to be some very significant breach of duty.
Good point. Well, I think this is an important story. And so often we of course, think that we can assume some responsibilities. But with the two stories we heard just a few moments ago, from Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins, and that, of course, was Cecil Harvell just a moment ago, indicates that, honestly, the simplest solution is just to ask for advice. And I'm going to just close by reminding you, don't hesitate to ask for that advice by simply calling 252 area code 726-9050, 726-9050. And, of course, go online to harvellandcollins.com. Spell out the word and, please. harvellandcollins.com. As always, Cecil, Wes, thank you very much for your time this afternoon here on Let's Talk Legal.
Thank you, Lockwood.